Hey, this is Evan Murray. Welcome to Music Industry Insights. You can get a hold of me at evan@musicindustryins.net. evan@musicindustryins.net. This podcast is kind of going to blow your mind a little bit, I think. My guest is an author, and I mean, this podcast is dense with information, and it's really got to do a lot with like analysis. So like analysis of festivals and music communities and culture and government funding. And William O'Toole is he's a music business philosopher, music business analyst, music business, he's a teacher and he's an author. I mean, this conversation travels around a lot of areas, and it's deeply insightful for anyone that's interested in the music business, for anyone that's interested in their music career, that's interested in different parts of the world. Like, we talk about the Middle East a lot in this. We talk about different parts of Africa. Like, there's a lot of content in this podcast. And if I seem like I'm being a bit ambiguous, that is not my intention. This conversation is not pure chaos. It is linear. It does follow a track. You can dig into it. You can attach to it. It's just about really interesting subject matter. William is an educator and an author. And like I said, it's like, you know, it. There's a big philosophical element to what he's all about as well. And he's had a couple books published, and I'm sure, you know, we did this probably a month and a half ago or two months now. And I'm sure his book must be published now. I just got so busy with the conference, the Live at Heart conference, because I did two of them this year. I did, you know, simultaneously as well, and the COVID thing and collecting videos from bands, blah, blah, blah. I got wrapped up so much into it. I just burnt out. It was a struggle to get back to these podcasts and start, you know, editing. Because, I edit them, right? I just don't put them out in their raw form. I like to spend time on them. I like to curate them. I like to give my synopsis at the beginning like I am right now. So, you know, I mean, it's important to me that if people come across this, that like this is actually going to be some kind of treasure that they find. And that's what I want it to be. And that's what my intention was when I did all of these podcasts, is I wanted it to be a treasure. I wanted it to be like a thank you, I guess, to the music industry, you know, for my career so far. All the traveling I've done, all the places I've been, I do think it's a wonderful life. It's true. There's not a lot of money in it. There can be a lot of money in it. There could be a lot of money in it. I've made a decent living, from the music industry. I mean, the pandemic has kind of completely compromised that. But this is, I guess, the reason why I'm saying all this stuff is this is also the reason why a guy like William O'Toole, you know, you find a guy like William O'Toole speaking on this podcast, because he's not a booking agent and he's not a, yes, he was a festival curator. Yes, he's been involved in that stuff, but he's not your typical music person. You're going to hear a lot of really interesting things in this podcast. So take what you can out of it, extract what you need, and please enjoy it.
Today I have a guest from Australia. His name is William O'Toole. He's a published author. Well, he's a couple things, and that's why I wanted to bring William on the podcast. I had met him during a live session discussion held by Borneo Place. Those are friends of our mutual colleagues and friends of ours in the region of Sarawak on the island of Borneo in the country of Malaysia. I found that what Mr. O'Toole was talking about was extraordinarily interesting, and I think that he comes from a unique place. that a lot of people in the music industry need to hear about, but also I think it's worth talking about and kind of gaining a deeper insight into what he's doing. Thanks for joining me today, William. Really nice to see you again. I know it was only maybe last week that we saw each other, but yeah, welcome to the show. And, you know, please introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about what you have done and what you're up to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And, for the opportunity to talk. It's a bit hard to, so I'll do it chronologically. It'll probably be the best way to do it. So I did mathematics at university. Once I left university, I had a choice of being an accountant or a statistician. So I chose music and I started playing and organizing music. Mostly concerts of various different kinds and dances. The idea was entertainment. So I did a lot of dances. And then I decided to make musical instruments. So I went over to Europe and spent a couple of years in England and got a band together there. And we performed in Europe. They're still going, by the way. We had our 40th anniversary the other couple of years ago. A band called Blowzabella. You ever want to look it up? It's very unusual, believe.
Blowzabella.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when I got back to Australia, I decided to form a band, which I did, called Sirocco. We toured a lot of places. And then I put together an agency in about 86. And the agency had to do with unique Australian music. Things that were really unique to Australia, and basically was part of the melange of music from Greece, from all kinds of places, including indigenous music, and which was unusual at the time because everybody was into rock and roll or jazz at that stage, or disco. So ours was very much live music, and the result was I had to go and get gigs for them, which meant that I had to go out and find work for all these people. And basically that was convincing places like shopping centres or malls to have festivals. They'd never done that before. You've got to remember, this is a long time ago. So No one had thought of this before. So I did a whole bunch of things like magic festivals. And then because I've done mathematics, I quickly got onto the software to run it all. So I wrote my own programs. And I realized a large part of it was project management. So I went back to university and did a master's in project management, and then they took me on to teach it. I'm trying to make it more interesting. But with the result,
it's quite interesting already, to be honest. I mean, it's kind of, really appreciate your approach that we're just kind of taking us through a timeline here. I love the
organization. Yeah, so no one had thought of using project management at that time for events. It just didn't even come into it. Most events at that stage were, you know, ad hoc, like the ones I did, where you just got it together. You know, you got a band, you got a hall, and you sold tickets. That was it, you know. But I was using project management to it, and then I thought, well, nobody's doing that, so I wrote a book on it. And in 1996 or somewhere around about then, the book took off and now is published in about six languages and is on its sixth edition or something.
Wow. And what is that book called?
And in that, I talked about festival and special event management. It's an international one. It's in Portuguese too, believe it or not.
Wow, okay.
As well as Indonesian and two types of Chinese. Anyway, the result was that really took off. And then I started, I suggested that also part of project management was risk management. So I went to these new standards that were starting and I said, look, nobody's teaching this stuff in events, you know. And so I started teaching risk management. Now, at that stage, no one had heard of that. I mean, zero, you know. And so that was quite unusual. And so I was picked up in various countries to go over and help develop their industry. And Dubai was one of them. So I went to Dubai in around 2000. And worked there helping to develop their industry. And at the same time, they asked me to put together strategies. In other words, what's the long term, like over 5 years, And with the result, I got picked up by the United Nations and sent to post-war zones like the Sudan and Liberia. And this was to help them get their events sector or concerts and the rest of it back working again. Because after 14 years of civil war, some of these places were pretty shot through, let's say.
socially decimated or socially challenged.
Yeah, completely. And events were very important to a lot of those places. And South Africa too. So I worked in South Africa, Uganda. That's a fabulous place. You ever want to go to a wonderful country? Worked in Uganda. Prior to that, I should add that the band that I had, we toured about 30 countries. And particularly places that were a little bit unusual, Laos, Vietnam, we went to Western China, to Nepal. We did 6 tours of India. That's a fabulous place for music, India, by the way. I mean, that's one place where people really appreciate artists and music, you know. So basically, I picked up quite a variety of how to deal with the world, because I had to tour the groups, remember. I had to organize the gigs to a degree with the locals, and then tour the groups, and you know what it's like working with the groups of musicians, and deal with all of that, and also make money out of it. So I did that, and so once I sort of started in Dubai and all those other countries I mentioned, I noticed a very common pattern of development. And I'd seen this in New Zealand, and Dubai sort of followed a New Zealand model in terms of the development of the industry, of the event sector. And so I was asked to come into Saudi Arabia at the time, which very few people went into.
No kidding.
By that stage, I'd done just about everything, so I wasn't worried about going to Saudi Arabia. And I worked there for the tourism body to develop their event strategy. Put that together over a period of about 10, 12, 14 years, on and off, you know, going back and forth. You know, I've been to the most fascinating parts of these world, you know. And don't forget, the year before last, 2019, Saudi Arabia spent billions of dollars on festivals and events. You know, Live Nation was big in that, by the way. You're talking of Live Nation before. They were very big in bringing in music acts into Saudi Arabia. Now, don't forget, up till then, music was forbidden. So it made quite big changes in these countries, the work I did. And so what I did is put together into a number of books. I've got about 7 of them out. And the latest one is the important one, because basically it's like a maturity model. You know, when you go to a country, and it could be Canada, and I've worked in Canada too, by the way. It could be Canada, it could be New Zealand, it could be the US, or any of these countries. They follow a model of development. And the events industry has been doing exactly the same as engineering or doctors or accountants or anything. You can almost map it, you know. And I've had the advantage because I zip around the world, you know. I forget how many countries, but I zip around the world and work with the locals, you know. Don't forget, I'm not working with expats in these countries. I'm working with locals. So I can see the same issues, the same problems arising, and the same similar sort of solutions. And that's that maturity model I talked to you a little bit about before.
Super interesting.
How's that sound? Oh, and I play the bagpipes.
Wow. So let me just, okay, so I'm going to kind of poke in and out of your story there, because there's a lot of,
sure.
I'm going to try to unpack this, because you got a lot of really super interesting content here. All right. So where do I want to start? I want to start with you going into countries and doing shows, you know, like you're kind of working in the event management part. So yeah. When you're doing this, are you still doing this? Like you said that you were throwing shows, you know, back in Australia in the 80s, you know, using shopping malls or town halls, and you weren't working with the popular crowd. You were working with more of the cultural aspect. So when you were going into these countries, was this kind of just kind of organizing event based on what they wanted to do, or were you kind of influencing you know, what they should be doing at the events as well? Like, was this just...
No. They were very good at it.
Okay. So they had a really good idea.
Oh, they know how to do things like this, where the West is very young when it comes to organizing events, man. You know, India, they put on weddings for huge numbers of people. They know how to put an event together, you know.
Yeah.
And they do it their own way, of course, and everybody understands how to do it. You do a gig in Japan, man. You want to see, I don't know if you've probably done one, but if you want to see how people organize, do a gig in Japan. In fact, they'll do it without even telling you. You know, to tell you something in some of these countries is an insult to you. They just get it done. Right. So there's quite different cultural ways of doing things, you know.
Very absolutely different. So what can you kind of define more of your role, let's say, when you would go in and say the UN is sending you into, like, maybe it's different. Is it, you know, you were mentioning there was a commonality about how you're identifying certain issues with how, you know, things are being organized or certain issues. Yeah. Like, there was a common thread you're mentioning. Can you explore that a little bit more? Like, can you explore more about what that was about?
Well, if you look at most places, like, for example, New Zealand or Dubai or Edinburgh, and you look at the history of events there, you'll find it all started the same. It all started with, I mean, this is post Second World War we're talking about. Okay, it all basically, although you go back to the States, it's after the Civil War. You had people who were entrepreneurs. They're the people who started events, you know, they're entrepreneurs, basically. With a result, there wasn't a system or anything. And the government basically kept out of it because the government, they didn't see the event industry. They didn't see what's called events. They just saw, you know, a conference here and a concert there and a exhibition there. And, you know, they didn't quite, which was good, you know, because that allowed the whole thing to flower through competition. And the events that were no good and the event managers that were no good eventually got the boot, you know, the promoters. So it called a variety of words too. You didn't even have the word event, for heaven's sakes. You had promoters and, you know, you had conference organizers and wedding planners and, you know, all these things. And it was all done through individual characters. And you know them because you've still got them in Canada. You've still got lots of them. And they're people with real character, with real sort of charisma, if you like, and they get events together. They get it together, right? The next phase that happens is the government, sponsors basically in a lot of cases and the venues, start asking for plans. Now, up till then, the plan had been the, let's say, the intellectual capital of the event manager.
Right.
They didn't show it to anyone. That'd be, you'd be nuts to show it to anybody, you know, because that's how you get the thing together. And we all know those guys because they still exist, by the way. All those people still exist, you know. The sponsors, you know, like some of the communication companies, et cetera, saying, well, where's your plan? You know, where's your marketing plan? And suddenly they had to come up with marketing plans, for example. So that's the next stage, right? And then the next one was when risk management suddenly hit the event sector and you had to get a traffic management plan together, for example. Then you had to get all kinds of other things, you know, like occupational health and safety or whatever you guys call it over there, workplace safety. Okay, you suddenly had to get all those things together for an event. Now, that was new. Originally, nobody did that sort of stuff. You know, nobody had a security plan. Security was never an issue. You know, crowd management might be, but security wasn't. And now that's the situation we're in now, that, you know, particularly with COVID, you're getting into new rules and regulations, man, and they're heavy-duty stuff. You know, for you to put on an event now in, let's say, in Australia, the number of codes and rules and regulations you've got is unbelievable. Just to put up a tent, I think I counted there were 14 codes, rules and regulations you had to do to put up a tent, right? So that's changed the industry dramatically, and it means that the big boys, you know, like Live Nation and that, are ruling the industry because the cost of entry for new people, you know, like the people that, you know, when I was young, where you came up with the idea for a concert somewhere and you just did it, right? The cost of entry now is just gigantic. And I think this is a disaster waiting for happen for events, but that's another issue.
Well, no, actually, I read it. You're speaking the truth here, because I read an article coming out of the Toronto actually, and that was about how insurance policies for venues have completely changed, and a lot of a lot of the insurance policies are now. I mean, these policies are actually going to be. It wasn't the pandemic. Because these venues are coming out of the pandemic now, but it's going to be the insurance and the policies that they're creating that's going to, now that's the new challenge, that owners have to swim through.
Yeah, but the insurance is just a result of risk management. I mean, that's it. I mean, that's what you're covering, and once, I mean, if there are any more, for example, terrorist attack at events, it's going to go through the roof. It's already closed stacks of events around the world, the whole terrorism issue, because they just can't afford. They can't afford the security and they can't afford the insurance. And this is at events that, no offense, the knitting festival out in the bush somewhere, they've got to fit into the requirements of the federal government, the national government, security. And it's just nuts. Everything's just gone crazy. And you've got to remember, it's easier for bureaucrats to have these sort of laws, but there's no penalty for a bureaucrat to bring in a new law, rule or regulation. There's no penalty to them. There's a penalty to us.
They're creating the penalties. Yeah. Now, the other thing I want to talk about too, so kind of just going back, circling back a bit here, say when you went into a place like Sudan or you went into a place like Saudi Arabia, can you talk more about specifically what your role was? So you would meet one of these characters, right? You'd meet one of these charismatic characters that had a lot of ideas. So were you kind of managing the manager? Is that what was kind of happening? Were you?
Yeah, I was on a meta. I was on a what we call now a meta level.
Right. Yeah.
My gig,
mentorship.
I wasn't managing them. You see, my gig was to inspire them, to show them a way out. I should be more specific here. Look, for example, when I went to Liberia, I went to a place called Monrovia, which is fascinating history, by the way. I don't know if you know, but after the Civil War in America, Liberia was set up to take the ex-slaves, and anyone who wanted to go back to Africa could jump on a boat and go back to Africa, and Liberia was the place.
I had no idea. This is absolutely fascinating. I'm a big history guy, too, and I had no idea.
Okay, so the place is called Monrovia, after the US president at the time, I believe. The capital is Monrovia. Okay, so everything went well because Liberia is an incredibly rich country. Like anything grows there. It's got everything. It's on the west coast of Africa, just above Ghana, all that sort of Ivory Coast area, if you're not familiar with it. Anyway, so everything went along swimmingly for a long time until there was a civil war. And then, as I said, for 14 years, about a third of the population were killed. I won't tell you how, because it's pretty horrific. So the UN went in there to try to, try to patch up what was going on. And I had already worked for the UN in other countries, and what they wanted to do was to train the locals in how to get festivals and events together. Back together. But what they specifically wanted was events and festivals that could bring in people from overseas that could eventually set up an event sector, in which case they could get in conferences and exhibitions from overseas.
And I'll just say in plain English, kind of normalize the society again, kind of thing, like normalize, people interacting and the potential for tourism or, all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Yeah, that's basically the idea. Yeah, exactly right. So my gig was just to work with the locals, and they would come up with event ideas, okay, and we would workshop them. And the idea was to create the industry such that it would be local events, not to go and bring in overseas events, because it's just not going to help them. You need them to come up with their own events, their own ideas, their own cultural events, etc. And from that, you'll get your supplies, you build up your capacity, right? Meaning and capability, which is capacity means that because you've got to build that up slowly. If you bring in outside people, they just walk away with all the money, you know, and the people don't get anything. The idea is to get these people trained up enough so that when they did negotiate with overseas performers, for example, you know, they knew how to do it. Right. You know, in that field, and you know how tough the you know the rock industry all the rest of it, I had to deal with it many times. Yeah, how tough they are, and you know they have no conscience. So if you build up these build up the local capacity to do it, and of course they were extremely smart people. You know, it was no trouble, and events is something they really enjoyed, so it was no trouble doing. And then I followed up afterwards as well. You know, because they only put me in for a couple of weeks into these places to do the training. Okay, and then I follow up. So I did a couple in Uganda, Sudan was another one, South Africa. Where else? A whole bunch of other places.
Well, it's fascinating.
I worked with the European Commission as well in Aqaba. Aqaba is in Jordan. It's at the top of the Red Sea. You look at it, it's quite famous because it was in the film Lawrence of Arabia. Okay. And it's just a fantastic place. I mean, just an amazing place. And I worked there for quite a while. I mean, when I say quite a while, like on and off, for you do a couple of months, and then you come back and redo a couple of months. And that was to put together their events strategy. How can they put on events there? You know, what do they want in 5 years' time?
Okay.
Not just what they want now, because events, as I try to explain to people, events are going to fail the first 2 years. You know, you put on a festival, you're not going to make money for a couple of years, right? And it's like any business. You know, the business has got to learn from the beginning, and eventually it turns a profit or a surplus or whatever you want to call it. But you've got to allow these things to grow. And that's why I say about this problem that's looming. The problem of rules and regulations being set for major events, but applying them to minor events and events that are trying to grow. You'll stifle it. You know, you'll stifle it with all these rules and regulations. There's got to be a way of innovation and creativity in events. You don't do that, you've got the end of the events industry. That's what events are, after all.
Yeah, people need to breathe. I mean, the organizers and the people that are actually telling you need to be able to breathe. And I mean, it sounds really like there's a lot of smothering going on. But I mean, it is, just to take this back a bit, I think the thing is also like when you're going into these regions that are troubled and you're getting the insight of how to, like, I mean, where government or say, you know, civic or regional, even government at the same time is looking to, you know, bring people together. They're working internationally now to talk about, you know, creating community spirit. And like you're inside of people with maybe their only exposure to these kind of events is, like you said, like weddings or these alternative kind of things, or their insight into like other places in the world. And you're like, are you going in there kind of with a regiment already? Like, or are you kind of talking to these guys in a developmental way based on their own creative ideas? You know, are you just kind of trying to, do you already have like a, you know, foundation that they can build upon? Yeah. Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's like engineering. I mean, that's what events are. I mean, events is no different from medicine, accounting, or engineering. There's a way of doing it. And it's been honed over many years, and they need to, you know, adapt it to themselves. But you start with the concept, and as you work your way through it, that's what you get. We do this in the States too, by the way. Every year I go to America, the US, and work with all the festival organizers in the US, and we have, I forget how many, we do it for about 10 or 15 years. And what we do is we pick a city, you know, it might be, where is it, say Pittsburgh or something like that. And we get all the events people, and these people run Memphis in May. You know, these are big events, some of these things, and they're from all the cities and towns around the USA, right? So every year there's a different bunch that come in. And what we do is we pick a problem in one city in America, and it may be along the Ohio River, you know, what's happened to the industry along the Ohio River, right? And then these people, the people come in from the city, they say what the problem is, and then for the next 4 or 5 days, All these people work on the problem and try to come up with an event solution to it.
Wow. Okay,
so it may be, I'm just trying to think of some of them because I've got other things on my mind, but the down on the, say, Mexican border, okay, it gets very hot, obviously, in summer, and so they had to come up with an idea for an event to get people there during summer, you know, creative ideas for events. And these people, like, it's just fantastic. I mean, what they come up with, I mean, the Yanks are still very creative, you know.
It's a lot of brainstorming, going on. And
but also they have to put together a proposal. They can't, it's not just, oh, we'll come up with an idea, you know, like.
Yeah, they have to construct, you're constructing a
yeah, it was a, sort of a, what was it, it's called Howl at the Moon. And it was a an event for bikes, you know, not motorbikes, but bicycle types, but adventure ones, you know. And it was going to be at nighttime, right, when it's cool. And they had to put not just the idea, they had to get who the sponsors were. It had to fit in with the strategy of the town. You know, what's the town going to do in the next 5 years? Will this event fit in with what the town will happen in the next? Where's the money going to come from? And then what are all the operational issues that you've got to look at? Then what are the risks? And how? What's the project plan? You know, when do you have to start? When do you have to do this? And that's what they do. And that's, we do this every year in the States, in Wheeling, West Virginia. They all come in.
All right. Well, I mean, this is, I mean, again, we're like, I mean, you're dropping seeds all over the ground here. And I'm just trying to, you know, there's so many seeds to pick up. Cause I mean, this is really, well, the content that you're speaking about is you're talking about like kind of the ethos of people gathering, the ethos of, you know, crowd gathering, and how music can kind of, you know, be inside of these crowds and how people come together. So, because I mean, these are also marketing platforms too. Like a festival is so many things. Like it's a, you know, not just, it's social, it's economical,
there's three returns on investment.
Right,
let me tell you. You're ready? There's three returns on investment. You can divide everything up into this. A festival, here's the lesson bit. You ready? A festival is an asset. And if you look at asset management, it'll tell you all about festivals and concerts and everything. You just have to know how to read the, you know. And an asset has three returns on investment. One is economic or commercial, i.e. it makes money. Two is goodwill, okay, which is brand, i.e. it tells you all about some city and, you know, like Dubai Shopping Festival, okay? And the third return on investment is social capital. And social capital means getting people together, you know.
Yeah,
and
making them happy that they spend more money and want to work.
Not just
more.
Happy, making sure they don't overthrow the government.
Right, yeah, there you go, okay.
In some of the countries, that was the aim, believe it or not. Right, you don't have happy people, they overthrow the government. Just have a look at the French Revolution. And so that was part of the aim in some countries, to get people to put on events, you know, it's to show that the government's doing something, you know, trying to help them.
And now, so when we come into the world now, like we're, you know, we're plagued by the fact that we don't have any mediums anymore. There's no places that people can gather to, like, no one's being told who's popular anymore. You know, people are kind of finding out on their own. It seems that the whole pop industry is kind of super diversified. We don't really have rock stars anymore, or the ones that we have are all dying out because there's no platforms for people to gain this new notoriety. You know, like, I mean, I guess 10 years ago, you could have mentioned 100, and nowadays you can maybe mention five on, you know, 10 or 5 or 10. Where is the music industry headed as far as you're concerned in this festival aspect? Do you think it's going to head more towards like inclusive cultural development, or how do you see this forming, William, like into the future?
Well, if you have a look at the music industry, it's dominated by the Yanks. End of story. That's it. You know, you can have the, it was dominated, and it still is in a lot of ways, by the Americans, okay? But that's going. I mean, they're no longer the power that they used to be in the world. So the question is, what's going to happen now? Well, you've got K-pop.
Bingo, yeah, there you go.
You've got a variety of things. I don't mind, because I was never involved in, I was never really involved in the pop industry. It didn't interest me whatsoever. It was too ephemeral. What I did, and if you look up Blowzabella or Sirocco music in Australia, you'll find out. What I did was look for a very special audience, a particular audience, but an audience that would crawl over glass to get to us. Okay, that's all I was interested in. All you need. I didn't want 200,000 people. What's the point? Why not get, say, 1,000? Why not get 500 paying good money to listen to you, and you do it a couple of nights a week? What is this thing with mega events? Do we really need them? Remember, they're modern. It's a modern concept, all of this. You know, the big stadiums and all the rest of it. Okay, this is all modern, except for the Romans, but even their stuff was small compared to what they're building now. You know, so this maybe this is a diversification, right? A diversification and a simplification. Well, not simplification, but diversification. It could make it complex, which is sort of good in a way, because what we're getting now is exactly the same. And this is what happens, by the way, when you get 50 lawyers running the biggest entertainment agency in the world. And what they do is they get rid of all the acts that don't earn the money over a certain percentage, and they throw all their weight behind the big acts. Well, they're going to die, mate, and you've got nothing to replace them. So what will happen is you will die. You know, that they will die. And that's what's happening, man. If the Saudis didn't bail them out, they'd be gone.
See, so that
I'm being obscure here on purpose.
Right. So this is a really interesting point too, because the industry has a responsibility for cultivation in order for the industry to be sustainable.
To a degree, yeah. Like, you know, as far as I'm concerned, look, just tell the governments to get out of the way, right? And tell all these big organizations to stop monopolizing, and we'll have a situation like we have with the restaurants, right? The reason you have good restaurants everywhere around the world is they compete with each other. Everybody's restaurants come and go constantly. And the moment that the government gets involved, what we get is the Soviet Union restaurants, where we have exactly the same thing to eat. Right. Whereas in the restaurant business, everything's competitive. You set up, it takes you a year or 2 years to get it together. That's the sort of model I like. Mind you, that's just me.
No. But I mean, yeah. I think this is worthy of a conversation. And, you know, even diving into this regimen of what you're talking about, because so let's look at the benefit of having these smaller shows, right? Where, you know, the thing is, if you have smaller shows, that means you can have more of them. Which means they'll be, if you have more of them, they'll be more competitive, which makes each event kind of more special in itself, which means you can have more bands or more artists opportunity to be at these events as well. So you have, this is more like, it's almost like if you deconstruct the one huge event and you break it across, everyone is going to benefit from that even more so. And I mean, let's just be honest.
Okay, except the monopolies. Except the monopolies.
Well, yeah.
See, what you're talking about you're talking about the economy of scale, right? That's what everybody is taught at university and economics and everything. Economy of scale. Just get it bigger and bigger, and then that cost of that sound system will go down because you'll amortize it over a lot of people, right? I'm talking about the economy of diversity.
Let's keep traveling down that road. Let's talk about
split it up into smaller concerts in terms of music. Have a lot more churn, a lot more. Why does everything have to be two guitars and a bass and a keyboard? Let's churn it up, man.
Okay.
You know, this is what I'm in favor of anyway.
Well, and I mean, one of the most interesting things about traveling, you know, I mean, I was a touring musician, I guess about 6 years ago. And then I kind of went into the music side as well. So I have attended conferences in quite a few countries in the world. And one of the most interesting things for me going to a different part of the world is the fact that it's different. You know, like there's nothing more disappointing than landing in India and walking out of the airport in Mumbai and seeing Burger King. Cause that's exactly what you see when you walk out, you know, when you walk out of the airport in Mumbai, the first thing you see when you land in India is Burger King. And I'm just like, what the heck? I'm like, no, you know, kind of thing. So But the thing is, when I did go travel into the south of India and the company I work with there, it is an alien experience. And that's exactly what makes human life rich. You know, I think it's so amazing that I've been able to be in countries where it is alien to what I know, you know? So that's one thing I really want to talk about. So when we talk about the actual music, I like, you know, and the thing is, like you're saying, like, you know, the big companies are pushing behind the big artists and these kind of things, and, you know, there's nothing to replace them. And maybe it becomes interesting if, you know, like this starts turning tourism on its head as well. Like tourism becomes a different thing. Maybe like people are going, maybe it's a better idea for people to go on, you know, to travel because they want to investigate something. They want to have a new experience. They want to do something unique in another country. You know, maybe the way tourism was in 1970, you know what I mean?
Earlier than that. Now I'm just rereading a fabulous book by Borstein, and it's called Pseudo Events. I was just reading the chapter on tourism, which is fabulous, you know, because he plots the difference between a traveler, that's someone who risks and actually is immersed in what they're doing, as the thing from a tourist. And a tourist is someone who sightsees, they just watch.
Right, they're looking for the best Western.
Yeah, the best way to watch is inside a car or out the window of a hotel or on a cruise liner. That's right. Tourism. And the result is, of course, everything becomes faux. You know, everything becomes Disneyland. Mm. Right? Everything is the simulacra or the pseudo.
Walmart.
Yeah. And what we're trying to do when I talk about the economy of diversity is to give real experiences on a much smaller scale, which I think you can do. And we'll see.
And maybe that becomes, either way. Well, no, that's so interesting. I mean, okay, so let's touch on this. We did touch on that. We've been kind of circling this like an eagle here, kind of picking up little pieces out of, you know, the event planning and stuff. But you're also an author. And I want to touch on this where, because this kind of catapulted your career inside of the UN and traveling in the countries. Was your book being published? Like you said, it's in six different, this is its sixth edition, and it's in how many different languages?
I forget. Okay. Because there's a couple of Chinese ones thrown in there too.
Okay. So you've continued working as an author as well, correct?
Yeah.
And you have a new book coming out too.
I do have a new book. Thank you very much. It's actually, the book is called Events, Feasibility and Development. Now, you've got to remember one thing.
Feasibility and Development. So let's just chew on that for a second. So, I mean, this is like how, like, first of all, maybe trying to create a sustainable business. Is that out of an event?
Yeah, but it's the events. It's plural, not singular.
Okay. Let's talk, like, please.
It's about what's called the portfolio of events. Yeah, because cities and regions and all the rest of it don't have one event. They have an event program. And the question is, well, what should be in that program and how do you develop that? And like a portfolio of shares, if you like, right? How do we renew that portfolio? You know, how do we stop it going stale? How do we make sure that we support events, which is what governments do, or at least keep out of the way, events that have the right sort of return on investment for our people? Right? So that's what it's about. And this is what I did in Saudi Arabia. I mean, the work in Saudi Arabia is very much like that, which is why it was a huge success. I mean, what's happening now with all the different events and festivals and everything in Saudi is a direct result of it. Excuse me. And so I plot all this and the sort of other types of work that I do. Okay, so Events, Feasibility and Development's on Routledge. It's the second edition because the first edition I wrote in 2011 was the sort of test case. And then I tested all that for the next 10 years in various countries. And so the second edition is the actual result of all of this.
Wow. Okay, so you had a hypothesis at first, right?
Yeah.
You had a hypothesis.
Yeah. It was a working hypothesis, though. There wasn't just, I didn't just sit there and, you know, think it up. I was actually doing it at the same time. So I was refining as I went through and I eventually got to the 2011 book. All right. And then I used that model in a variety of other countries, you know, some of the countries I've told you about. Okay. And it worked really well, hence the second edition. There you go.
Man, it's interesting. Okay. So I'm going to keep poking at this bear here because it's a bear with a big brain. So let me just keep going, traveling into your book here. So I'm going to try to summarize some things where we're headed because I don't want to kind of get lost in the trail. Cause I mean, we can, so many trails to, you know, to explore here. So you're coming from a mathematical background at first, you know, but you know, and you talk about, you know, economics and these kind of things, but you go into the music industry, you're kind of booking unique events. You're using your creative mind to kind of try to gather people and to try to, you know, step up the industry, and you know, you're kind of exploring who you are and what you're doing. This turns into something that's actually you like, and you're also a musician and you're playing in bands as well. So this is something that starts becoming, you're passionate about it. You start registering, you start seeing things, and you're like, hey, I should jot down this information. I think it'd be actually useful for other people, or people would be interested in what I'm learning. You do this and people are interested. And this, you know, this is a proclamation that people are saying, hey, this guy has something to say, to the point where the UN gets involved. And now you're into countries that are either coming out of extreme, you know, social unwellness, or countries that, you know, governments want people to be a little bit more happy and to kind of explore their own creative ideas. So, right. you're doing this over a number of years. So, I mean, like, you know, this is an extraordinary life at this point because you're experiencing a lot of cultures. You're experiencing a lot of things that are happening. And I mean, you're continuing your work as an author as well. So as you're identifying how these things are, you know, kind of happening around you and how you're working inside of them, now you start writing about that as well, which, you know, you're released. And then, because that's not only the hypothesis of how you see the industry working, but that's how you're making the industry work. And now, right. Is that fair to say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now you're getting to a point where you're summarizing this stuff because now you know the results of your work. And now this next book that's coming out is actually the information of how these things worked inside of that hypothesis and how you think it can work for other people or to kind of gain the benefits from the experiences you've had previously. Is that a fair statement?
It is. Magnum opus.
The magnum opus. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, of what I do. It really is the top. I should mention, by the way, just out of interest here, hang on, while I get you back. I should mention that in 2018, I was inducted into the International Festival and Events Association Hall of Fame for that year for the work that I did around the world. Okay, so it's sort of been recognized by the IFEA, they're called, International Festival and Events Association. They, if anyone's interested, there's a whole video on YouTube with pictures of the stuff that I've done. Yeah.
Now, when we talk about more so the information, because I mean, obviously, like, how many chapters are in this book? Is it okay if we dissect this book a little bit? Because I'm kind of...
Yeah, sure. It's divided into three sections. Okay. The first section is about the maturity model, which what happens is that a city or a country or a town measures where they're up to on this maturity model. It's a series of tables with a series of questions. Okay, and it says things like, do you have training in situational analysis? Okay, or situational awareness. Now, that's extremely important in terms of risk management, and that shows a certain level of risk management. And that's in that. That's one example of a question. There's questions you go through it, and then it will put you where you are in the maturity model, and then it's just up to you where you want to go.
Wow, that's interesting. I mean,
it's a gap. What's called a gap analysis.
Right.
It just you fill it in. It puts you into the to where it is, and it's up to you where you want to go. I mean, maybe you want to stay in the overregulated, monopolized part of the industry, or maybe you want to go that next step, which is, as I said, where New Zealand and Dubai and Edinburgh have gone, you know, where they're reintroducing innovation and creativity into events. And they realize that all of this can't be captured by a bureaucratic process, that there has to be a way of revitalizing the industry constantly and having a churn.
Well, I want to talk about this for a second, you know, the way that the way I'm perceiving it, because I think what you're doing is you're also creating you're organizing a landscape. You're organizing a module. So the thing is, like, you know, if I read this, I'm asking myself questions and I'm starting to identify who I am inside of this module. And then the thing
Yeah, you're right. So with regard to world best practice, it's pretty straightforward. I know world's best practice because I travel the world. No one else does, because no one does what I do, right? Most of the events people are too busy putting their events on, which is fair enough. I mean, that's their job. But who's doing the meta level? Nobody. Do you understand? Nobody is doing the meta level. Nobody's looking at it from above and looking down and seeing how it's all moving around. The UN doesn't do it. No one does it, except me.
Well, the thing is, too, is
I'll be the only one.
Yeah, but I mean, what's interesting for me, coming from the industry perspective and looking at it, is I'm seeing this as like, all, you know, like there's like personality tests, you know what I mean? Where they ask you a certain questions and you kind of find out where you are at cognitively. And I mean, what you've set up is a module. So someone that's interested or someone that has experience understands where they are cognitively on the scale of things. So, I mean, it's exceptional because I've never heard of this, you know, I'm doing conferences all over the world. I'm working with companies all over the world. I've never heard of this type of thinking because it sounds to me like it's coming from a psychological background, obviously, but also a very deeply organized as well. So this becomes a tool, a very powerful tool.
There's two, actually. The one that you should have a look at is called the competency model. Okay. All this originated, by the way, with software development. It was called the capability maturity model. Okay. And there's a thing called the competency model, which I use or have been using for the last 30 or 20 years. And that is to identify the gaps in knowledge for people who do events. And I'm not talking about doing just one type of event.
Yeah.
In the countries I go into, those people are just as likely to run a conference as a concert. Okay. And that's very important to have that multi talent. Like Gracie, you know, Gracie, who we talked to the other day, she does all kinds of things. She does all kinds of events. So maturity model for competency is a good one too. That's part of it too. And that's identifying gaps in your knowledge. And it's up to you whether you want to fill them or not. I mean, maybe you couldn't care less if in certain areas because it doesn't interest you. But we started that in the year 2000. It was called EMBOK, Event Management Body of Knowledge. And we got together in South Africa because the South Africans wanted it. And for the next 7 years, we met about three or four times with all the events people, you know, and all the rest of it from around the world. We all flew in and we put together this whole model. And then the Canadians took it, believe it or not. So we worked in Canada for a bit in Ottawa. And put together what the Canadians called the International Event Management International Competency, International EMIX, it's called. And the conference people took it on straight away. So MPI Web, you know, the biggest meetings professional international, the biggest conferencing sort of association, took it on as their standard. Okay, wow. And it's still there. And I use it a lot because it identifies what the people know when you're trying to train events people, you know what they know and what they don't know. They do their own self-competency test to work out what parts are missing, okay? And then it's up to them whether they want to fill it or not, you know.
So what you're doing in this book in the first part is that are you kind of rendering your own version of this or like an updated version of what you're talking about then? Like, are you consolidating?
Yeah, the maturity model's complete. Yeah.
Consolidating the maturity a lot model, of information. Is that
fair? Yeah, a lot. Yeah. The maturity model I put together in the year 2000, okay, plus the MBOK. I did all this in the year 2000 and spent the next 20 years testing it all out and finally coming to the conclusion that's in the book. Okay, so the first part of the book, as I said, is divided into three. The first part looks at this maturity model, but plus it also looks at event strategies. And this is the big thing that's happening, including in Canada and in quite a few cities in Canada, is that you're getting together five-year strategies for events. Okay, and that's whether you put on your event or not, is whether if it fits in with the strategy for that city. Ottawa is a good example. Okay, they have an event strategy, so do most of the cities in Canada, but also in New Zealand and a few other countries. So it describes how to put a strategy together for a city or a town or what. and so that's the first part. So that's sort of, let's say, the big picture of events. The second part of the book is about management. And then it looks at what's called process mapping management. Okay, and this hasn't been done in events, although I've done it for 20 years for various companies. Don't forget, I've worked for Deloitte and all the big consulting companies. They often call me in because they get the events are now worth billions of dollars, right? So, and often though city will hire Deloitte. Who are fantastic to work for, I might add, and they then call me in as a subject matter expert, and in quite a lot of cases, the sort of stuff, you know, they recognise how important it is. Deloitte, by the way, if you're not familiar, is the biggest management consulting company around the world. The other model, Boston Consulting Group and Accenture and all that. I've all done a bit of work for all those guys, but particularly Deloitte is the one that I work for in the Middle East and places like that. Anyway, so a lot of consulting companies are about process mapping event management. It doesn't mean much. You have to actually have a look at it in the book. And really, it's just what you do. It's just saying, this is what we do. Right. That's the second section. And the third section was originally about operations. And I've sort of put that online rather than put it in the book because operations is more a hands-on type thing. So what I did talk about, and this is going to be very controversial, is training and teaching in event management and the problem with courses around the world.
Now, are we still... Forgive me, like I want to anyone that's listening to this, I want to keep them tied to the rope kind of thing.
Yeah.
We're still talking about the first out of your three sections. We're still talking about the first.
No, we've done the third section now. That was the third section. Okay, first is strategy. First is meta strategy. Second is management processes. And third is the operations.
Okay. So let's take one step back inside of the step. So the first step is that you're creating a module where people can identify their strengths and their weaknesses, right?
First part's more about the cities and the towns and cities, suppliers, event companies. Yeah. The first part's more about that. Okay. The second part is very much about identifying individual event managers or people in events, the strengths and weaknesses.
Okay. So that's
the management section.
Okay. Now, in the third one, you're challenging the way the world is already operating inside of this. Can we talk about that a bit?
No, well, the third part's about looking at, a few things. It's got about event metrics. It's basically about operations like logistics and that. But as I said, I don't go too much into that because, you know, it's staging and things like that. It's not sort of part of that book. I got other books on that if you want that. The main part of the third part is an analysis of event courses at universities.
Talk to me about that.
Well, if you're a student, for example, and you want to do events, and lots of students do, right, they've really got to know how to assess a course. There's a number of big issues with regard to
courses. The university needs to know how to assess, but the students need to assess the course if they're going to go into it. Is that what you're trying to say?
They need to know. Okay. Because they're going to pay money. They're going to spend two years of their lives.
Right, okay.
Right, so they should be able to. They don't just go to a university and go, "Oh, event manager, that looks good," and read the marketing material. Because the marketing guys have got no idea what they're talking about. What they need to do is assess a course, right? And I know the courses around the world, right? They use my textbooks. So what happens in this third part is that I talk about how important hands-on experiences for events, that you cannot do a course in event management without having hands-on unless experience in operations.
Right, or tagging with someone to do an event is what
you've got to have hands-on experience. There's no two ways about it. All the risks are at the event. The biggest risks are things at the event, someone getting killed, someone falling off a stage, the terrorists turning up and shooting people, right? That's real risk. The other risk, which is things like financial risk or reputation, is nothing compared to what could happen at your event if you make a stupid mistake. And you know that, you know, it's you get the wrong people at the event, you know, laying cables or something like that, you're asking for trouble. So it's very important that every event course, number one, should have hands-on experience. They should be able to go to events and work on events. That's part of it. Otherwise, no matter what you teach them, it will be wrong, because the most important thing has to do with operations on the day of the event.
Experience. Okay? So that's number one.
Number two, the event course must have people teaching it who have run events. You cannot have academics teaching this. Right now, people say, "Oh, why not?" Well, have a think about a medical course, right? Imagine someone teaching medicine to somebody who's only ever read a book about it.
Yeah, exactly.
You get it? And remember, a doctor's in charge of one person. You guys are in charge of 10,000 or 20,000 people. Your duty of care is exactly the same as a doctor, only it's multiplied by 20,000. And this is what I'm saying for courses around the world. Now, this is going to cause a furor, because what's happened is a lot of courses have just hired academics to teach it, and all they do is use a textbook. Look, most textbooks, not the one I just wrote, but most textbooks, right, are written with secondhand information. Do you realize that? They're not written from first-hand information. Imagine a medical thing, someone writing a medical thing without any medical experience. Man, you wouldn't read it. It'd be stupid. It's the same with events. You know, you can't have people writing books with secondhand information. That is nuts. They must have experience, because you must have a priority. You know, all the information is about prioritizing what's important. And on the day of the event with a crowd is what's important. And if a person doesn't have experience in that, then you're asking for trouble. Now, this could lead to legal problems in the future, by the way. It hasn't as yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if you know, there's going to be a disaster at some event and they'll trace it back to the university who trained that person.
I get what you're saying, because you're talking about intersection now. And this kind of intersection comes from someone needing a certificate to actually run an event. So it's becoming regulated. And then once you regulate it, the person that's training is actually signing off on the regulation, or the university is. But maybe that person is only a textbook person and never been to an actual event. So they're just basically, you know, kind of reinstating someone else's words that they created based off, you know, being organizational, let's say, and then something happens and they trace it back and say, "Oh, like, how do we fix this now?" But the problem is the seed. You're talking about the way this is seeding itself and the way that it's going to grow, or, you know, is that it, we have to try to talk about the germination of this seed first. So the people that should be giving the instruction, the people that should be educating people in the universe at a university level, don't need to be a professor. They need to be a person with real life experience.
Yeah, which is what happens in medicine. It's what happens in engineering. I mean, imagine engineering. Imagine being taught by someone in engineering who's never actually been an engineer or had experience in engineering. And the way they do that is the way that it should be done in events. And that's work experience at the same time as you do your course. You know, I can't see any problem with it. And imagine you'd have tons of students working for you, right? And they'd be so happy because they're going to get a certificate for it. And this is what we set up in South Africa. But unfortunately, a lot of the unis like just treat events as though it's nothing. Now, basically, that's where the problem is.
Right, like it's most, a free flow.
At a university, they just think events. They just think you're a party organizer. That's all they think you are.
Right, and but the thing is,
they do serious stuff.
Well, they're not realizing the significance. Like everybody knows the significance of gathering thousands of people. It's a very significant thing. It's a very significant thing for tourism and the economy, and it's very significant for so many parts of life. And the thing is, what you're saying is like this: if it's serious enough, that government will give hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars over a course of a year, society should probably take it seriously too, like at the university level. And I do agree with you 100%, because when we look at export strategies, let's say, now I'm going to move this a little bit. I'm going to stay in your world, but the thing
I have to, we've got a sort of time thing here. I haven't got much more time, by the way.
Okay. But the thing is, a lot of the people that are working in, say, the export or working on export, you know, they don't have the same qualification that they should either. They're handling hundreds of thousands of dollars for governments, and they just don't have the insight or experience, let's say, of, you know, really being able to see inside of what can be the most beneficial course. So William, I'm going to take you, we'll wrap this up here and kind of put a knot in it. When's the book being released? Who's the
book
primarily? November.
Okay. November. Yeah.
And say that again.
It's on Routledge is the name of the publishing, English publishing. Okay, but Routledge. You'll be able to find it. Yeah. Okay. Routledge, yeah.
And you could find that through, say, if I go to like Amazon or Google Books,
type in William O'Toole Events.
William O'Toole Events, okay.
So yeah, the Google, man, you'll have my face everywhere.
and how do you, what's your hope that when someone reads this book or a number of people read this book, what's your hope into the future about what this can kind of, you know, propagate or, you know, can start doing?
Well, I think it should, for myself, I hope it gets me work. That's number one. That's always handy. I like going into places that need to develop events, you know, and there's still a lot of countries, right, that could benefit from what I have to do, right? So I'd love to go to other places. Like, there's still a lot of countries I'm working. In terms of the countries and the cities and the regions, I think what I'm hoping that they do, that they can look at the, it's already been used, by the way. I meant to tell you that in the States, there was a group, a festival group. They do about 6 or 7 big festivals, and they've already used it, their tables to pitch where they're at in terms of risk management and crowd management. And they've gone to their people and had a look through it and assessed their event, et cetera, and then used that to close the gaps. Okay. So it's already been used, this sort of stuff. So I'm hoping that that this will show that this will open people's eyes that this is a highly professional industry around the world, that it has huge returns on investment for countries and for everybody. That the UN, for example, should have it as a profession, or it should have it as a sector in the industry. The reason that nobody knows about events is that the UN and various organisations don't have events as a sector, even though it's probably up there in terms of money. I mean, the wedding industry alone is worth a fortune, but concerts and all the rest of it, you put it all together and you've got a very big industrial sector around the world called events, you know. If that could happen, that would be good. But just showing specific cities and towns the way forward, I think would be, you know, to show them what it's going to be like in a few years' time. And also with regard to the maturity model, I'm hoping that we come out of this COVID thing with people realizing that monopolizing and getting things bigger and bigger and bigger, like the events, is not the way to go. That if you're going to do that, you really have to have smaller events and innovative events like they're doing in, as I said, New Zealand and these countries, looking at small ones, tiny ones, and they can be just as important. A good example of this, by the way, is that universities, a lot of courses, they only teach mega events. And they don't even realize that's what they're doing because they believe that is the event sector.
Right.
They don't realize that the wedding industry is bigger than the whole lot. Right, in the Middle East and places like that. And they don't even talk about weddings. When I've actually mentioned weddings, and I've done, I don't know if you've done any, but I've done a few. when I ever mentioned, they all just dismiss it as though it's not important. And yet it's the most important thing for a lot of people in their whole life.
In their whole life. It's the center of their life. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it is. It's like everything the event sector is about, for heaven's sake. And yet all they'll do is focus on, you know, the next soccer game or the Grand Prix or something like that, or Nicki Minaj concert.
When everyone else is having weddings. And I mean literally everyone.
Yeah, right? Think about it, you know. It'd be really good if they could look at that. You know, like street soccer. I don't know if you know about street soccer, right? Street soccer is everywhere, all around the world, right? Small cricket matches, things like that. That's the events industry. The events industry, not FIFA. That's just one tiny.
That's Coca-Cola, right? That's Coca-Cola.
Yeah. the real events are those people getting together, having street soccer or having basketball tournaments down the road. You know, stuff like that. That should be part of the event sector as well, and that's where the creativity comes from. Those sort of people.
You're right. Have a skating. People. That's actually people just acting as people, right?
Exactly. I mean,
this is what people are doing.
Yeah. And you can make money out of it. It can be larger events. And a good example of that is skateboarding. Have a think of skateboarding. Is that what you call them over in Canada? Yeah. Think of that. Have a think of how that started. That started just by people, you know, closing off a street, putting in a few ramps, and doing it. And now it's become a sport, you know.
It's a culture. And it's also a culture. There's a whole culture of that, right? I mean, we could go on and on and on and on, but
I know. I better get going.
I appreciate your time, and it's really
my pleasure.
It's a super interesting conversation. I have no idea how I'm going to summarize this when I introduce this, but by the time someone's listening, they already know that. Man, thank you so much, William. And
I'm
going to be checking into what you're doing, and I hope everyone else does too. And I hope stay in contact because you're an amazing guy and super, just your brain's on fire and I'm on fire now too. So let's see where this goes.
Good. Okay. Well, I'm going for a glass of wine now.
All right. Take care of yourself.
After all of it. Right. Thank you very much. Right.